welcome to the Managing Violence Podcast, the internet's leading free resource on violence prevention, threat assessment, personal security, and self-protection, brought to you by R2S Violence Prevention. We are hashtag for the protectors. I'm your host, Joe Saunders. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Managing Violence Podcast. Today, I'm going to be joined by Mike Roach. Mike is a near 40-year veteran of law enforcement in the United States, 26 of those years spent in the Secret Service, and has also authored a book on mass killers, which we'll be talking about, which is sadly topical and continues to remain topical. But before we get into Mike, I just want to mention that if you are in the United States, and especially if you are going to the Global Security Exchange in Atlanta, so it's the GSX conference in Atlanta on September 12 through 14, I will be there. So if you want to catch up with me, if you want to see my session, I'm speaking at 10 a.m. That's 1000 hours in Atlanta on Monday the 12th. I am the first session on day one. Just have a look at your program for whatever room number I will be in, but I will be in Atlanta and presenting on customer-initiated violence. So if you are in the security industry and you want to go see that, I highly, highly recommend checking out the GSX, the Global Security Exchange, at the World Congress Center in Atlanta, Georgia. I look forward to meeting with as many of you as I possibly can. I will have some copies of my book, and I'm going to be hanging out for 3 days, and actually a few more days afterwards as well in Atlanta. So if you're around, please make sure you come say hi. All right, I'm going to jump straight into the interview. Here we are with Mike Roach. Welcome back to the Managing Violence Podcast. It has been a minute since our last episode, but I am absolutely thrilled today to be joined by Mike Roach. Mike is a highly experienced law enforcement officer with over 40 years of experience, including 26 of those years in the U.S. Secret Service. He's also written several books. One of those books that we'll be talking about today is Mass Killers, How You Can Identify Workplace, School, or Public Killers Before They Strike. It's a book that is sadly timely, but has been timely many times over. So I'm hoping that we can have a very detailed conversation about some of Mike's learnings from the threat assessment, threat management, and investigations that he has carried out. But Mike, thank you very much and welcome to the show.
Oh, Joe, it's my great honor to be on here. Like I said, I've been a fan of the show for a long time. And when you reached out and asked me if I, come on, I was just extremely humbled and honored, knowing that the parade of esteemed guests that you had on there in the past. I call myself a student of life, and the day I stop learning is the day I stop living. And you are always pushing out great content. So thank you for that.
I very much appreciate the kind words. And whenever anyone says that, I always just say, well, look, I've done very little other than just ask questions.
But you have great insight too. So,
I appreciate that. So Mark, look, this could be a very heavy conversation, but I think given the people that actually listen to this show, I think we're probably not afraid of heavy conversations, but talk us through just a little bit about your career and your interest in mass killers, active shooters. How did that start to become an area of fascination for you?
So I started out a long time ago, many decades ago, as a patrol officer in the Little Rock, Arkansas Police Department. And for those that aren't aware, Arkansas is kind of in the middle of the country, just above Texas. Texas is a border state. It was at one point the most violent small city in America. And for a 200,000 population, they just had their 51st homicide. So it kind of gives you an insight of, the working conditions. And it was a great place to learn how to interact with people and dealing with violence. And after about 10 years, I left there and had a short stay with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. And then moved on to the Secret Service, where I did a total of 26 years there. And I bounced around from New Orleans to Miami to Washington, D.C. to Tampa, back to Miami again. So, I would say my real interest came when I was assigned to Washington, D.C. I was assigned to the Protective Intelligence Division, and that was right at the time, if your viewers are aware, of the National Threat Assessment Center that was just starting that they were conducting their research. They hadn't been formally established yet, but they had conducted the Exceptional Case Study Program, which was analyzing those that were intended on targeted violence towards our political figures. So I became intrigued with that. And then shortly thereafter, I went out on a trip with President Clinton to Oregon, and we visited the site of a school shooting in just outside of Eugene, Oregon. It was actually in Springfield. And, you know, as I sat there, I was looking at this small school and the small cafeteria and with the beautiful, majestic mountains. And I just sat there and I wondered what would possess a young student to go in and start gunning down his fellow classmates. And this was after he had already killed his parents. And from that, I just, became very intrigued by conducting threat assessments, and that became the focus of the remainder of my career. So
it's probably something that we can just quickly unpack for those that maybe aren't familiar with the U.S. law enforcement environment. I think a lot of us, especially outside of America, see the Secret Services just being the president's protection detail, and maybe aren't aware of all the other things the Secret Service are involved in and all the other activities and parts of the Secret Service. You sort of quickly, I guess, just a 30-second sort of snapshot of some of the things that you're involved with in your career in the Secret Service, just for context?
Yeah, sure. So obviously, most people are familiar with the fact that we protect the president, vice president, and visiting foreign dignitaries. So, the heads of state from Australia and New Zealand and whatnot, when they come in, the Secret Service would provide protection for them as well. And then we also conduct, criminal investigations of threats against our protectees, as well as investigation of counterfeit currency, cyber crimes, financial fraud, all of that as well.
Yeah. All right. So, look, let's. I'm not going to dance around the elephant in the room, especially as a non-American looking in at the U.S. It's such a complicated picture. But in terms of looking at the number of shootings, the active shooter threat. This, and every American loves having an Australian comment on gun culture. I won't do that. It's a complex problem to solve. It's not as simple as, you just need gun laws. Now, that doesn't necessarily solve it when there's so many firearms already in circulation. I've been on the record before and said, while I'm pleased that that Australia enacted the gun laws that we did at the time that we did. If I was living in the US right now, I think I would probably be licensed and carrying most of the time, even though I'm pleased I don't have to here. Just being cognizant of the threat. So with that in mind, going deeper than just proliferation of firearms, what is it that makes the U.S. a bit of an outlier in terms of volume and severity of these incidents? Not to say they don't happen elsewhere, but certainly the volume is pronounced in the U.S.
Yeah, so, I mean, and like you said, Joe, it is a very complex situation. And obviously, there is the availability of firearms as well. Which are always, an efficient means of killing people. And, the one thing I always say too is that, and again, I'm not a big gun person. I mean, I carried one because, that was a tool of my trade. We've also seen situations where most of us have, a 2,000 or 3,000 pound vehicle, potential weapon parked in the driveway as well. And we saw that certainly in the Christmas parade. And then just recently, this past weekend, there was another individual that in Pennsylvania ran into a charity event and killed one person. And we're seeing that more often overseas as well. So I think if you take all the weapons away, there's still, you know, we saw the Boston bombers as well utilized pressure cooker bombs. The Columbine, that was really a tragedy that was averted in the fact that they had a significant propane bomb set up in the cafeteria expecting to explode. And by their estimates, there would have been somewhere around 500 students in that the cafeteria at that time. Fortunately, a malfunction and didn't go off. So, you know, it's just sadly has become part of the culture here that, you know, again, a lot of them are on the cusp of looking to commit suicide, and that they look at that and decide, you know, I'm just going to try to, you know, instead of in the past, maybe, you know, sitting in their car and, you know, in the garage and letting it run, or going into the closet and killing themselves, they now decide, hey, I want to make a statement about my life. I want people to remember me. I want to put an exclamation mark after my name so people are going to remember, and I'm going to take as many people with me as I can. And this is, you know, sadly become, you know, part of our culture, and it's a sad testimony.
I'm glad that you raised those points, because what I don't want to do is start the interview with everyone who's not American going, well, that doesn't happen in my country, and therefore this isn't really relevant to me. Australians that are listening now, who make up about, last I checked, about 13% of the audience, but we just had a potential active shooter event at a Canberra airport, so a national airport, where thankfully it didn't appear there was any intent to cause injury, but we had allegedly a 63-year-old man who walked into the airport, sat in the check-in area, and then calmly pulled a pistol from his an illegally owned pistol from his backpack and fired at least 5 rounds into glass panels before he was apprehended. So unclear as to yet, this just happened over the weekend, so unclear as yet as to what the motives were or what his intentions were, but it does go to show that despite the gun laws and the controls and the fact that it's not common here, there's a potential that could have been a mass casualty incident. We've had random stabbings over the quote-unquote random stabbings. You and I know they're very seldom actually random. We've had those sorts of attacks. We've had vehicle-borne attacks. All over the world, we've seen people that have been at their wit's end or have decided to, as you say, commit suicide in a blaze of glory and have found ways to take other people with them. And that is something that we have to be mindful of. And we'll talk about some of the motivations and some of the things that may be warning signs. One of the things that you mentioned just then was suicidal ideation, or actually being suicidal as a prerequisite for these attacks. And it's something that a couple of years ago, I forget where I actually was talking about this, but that the most dangerous criminal is one who doesn't actually intend to get away with their crime, right? So that certainly changes the risk profile, because you can plan a lot more things when you don't have to have an escape plan.
Correct.
And especially if the end goal is suicide by cop or suicide before the police arrive, then that's very, very difficult from a response point of view to be able to really do anything about that. And I think that's probably where I'd like to steer the conversation. There's a lot of conversation around response and whether we have armed security or whether we need to have armed teachers or whether we need to have, you know, people with guns on site to stop these things from happening. And there's an argument for that. But again, response is so limited, and it's going to come usually after there's already been a casualty. So what are the things we should be doing to prevent this? And that's a really big question, so I'll focus a little bit and say, what are some of the behavioral warning signs that you've noticed from all your investigations or your research that everyday citizens should be looking out for?
Okay, so first I want to say the one thing there that you brought up was that So often we're focused on the reactive nature, but you know, and my philosophy always is, hey, once the shots are fired and the 911 calls are made, it's too late. People are going to die. People are going to get hurt. And that the idea is to try to stop that beforehand. And, you know, recently I had made a similar statement in a LinkedIn forum, and somebody came back and posted a picture of this bulletproof classroom and, you know, some of the security enhancements that they could do in that classroom and shutters coming down and all that. And I said, you know, that gee, that looks great. I don't know what the expense is, you know, in order to put that into to play. But what happens if, you know, considering that 90% of the school shootings are committed by students, what happens if the student is actually sitting in that classroom and pulls the gun out of his waistband and starts shooting? Then that classroom is, you know, neutralized at that point. But so I always look at, you know, security is a layered approach, as you well know. And I look at threat assessments as being kind of the smoke alarm. It is the first layer of security where hopefully you can identify somebody that is displaying concerning behaviors, address that individual, find out what the problems are, how far they've progressed down the so-called pathway to violence. And if you can find a so-called exit ramp for them to exit off of that pathway and mitigate that violence and stop it before it ever happens. And I know we've been successful numerous times, and rarely does that ever get publicized. Obviously, you know, that the mistakes are the ones that land up on the front page of, you know, every, you know, newspaper and every news program. But And they have to be called out, because sadly there have been some horrific failings. You know, we can look at, you know, say Parkland, Florida, at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School there. In that situation, here you had a student that had been interviewed by the police, or the police had been called to his house 43 separate times, and they interacted with him 21 times. Now, you would hope that somewhere along the way, one of those deputies might have said, hey, listen, you know, I'm really concerned about this person's behavior, and I'd like to direct him to the threat management unit for additional follow-up. But the only problem was the sheriff's department didn't have a threat management unit at that time. They do now. But you know, we spend a great deal of money, you know, and most police academies will teach them how to respond to an active shooter event, you know, and this is how you're going to go in. This is going to have how you stack. And we saw, you know, obviously failures at Parkland and in Uvalde as well. But I don't think much time is focused during the police academies in dealing with, you know, arming the police officers with, hey, these are the skills you need, and these are the warning signs you should be looking for. And, you know, when we're talking about warning signs, over 80% of these individuals have what we refer to as leakage. And that is the easiest way for us to identify, you know, problems. And almost after every one of these incidents, we'll hear from, sometimes it's members of the community, sometimes it's people that were on social media with these individuals, that say, oh yeah, he was saying this or he was saying that and making these threats, very concerning statements. And, you know, it's kind of surprising that, you know, especially in social media, they can moderate, you know, content based on what you're putting up there concerning COVID or certain political races and whatnot. But they seem to be having difficulty trying to identify this type of language. And again, we don't know what we don't know, and we have to rely on the community to report these types of behaviors to individuals. And so many of these people, and please jump in at any time there, Joe. I don't want to keep going on up along.
Actually, I would just pause there just because there was something you said about, I think leakage is such an important topic from a general citizen's point of view. We all have contact with people in our lives that there'll be people, whether it's professionally or in your family or whoever, that you're like, oh, if anyone that I know was ever going to do something bad, it'd be that person, right? We all have that person in our lives, and hopefully it's always, they're kind of just a minimal outlier, not a massive outlier. But one of the things that I think social media has amplified for us, and it could be an argument as to social media accelerating the number of mass casualty events we've had, is that often when people voice a desire, they're kind of just putting it out there to see what the response is. And if there's one positive response to what they've voiced, that validates the whole idea for them if they're already on the fence about it. And I'm thinking about the Christchurch mosque shooting that we had a few years ago in New Zealand, where offender had publicly stated his intentions on 4chan, I think it was, off memory, and literally was encouraged by people on that forum, who I'm certain most of the people that responded in a favorable way or in a laughing way or in a, we're not expecting him to follow through. It was banter. It was so many random weirdos on the internet, you know, whatever. Like it's victimless to encourage this. But if you're in the mindset where you're considering whether or not you're going to go ahead and do this, and one person says, "Yeah, do it. That's a great idea," that's all you need. That's a green light now, because we all want some sort of social validation, I think that is such a powerful thing to think about. Like when it doesn't even have to be about mass killings, right? Domestic violence, or I'm going to rob a bank, or I'm gonna steal that car. Oh yeah, go on, do it. And all of a sudden, like, oh, holy shit, my friend's stealing a car. That kind of thing. We have to be so careful of that. But coming back to leakage, I've talked to so many teachers over the years. I just got a notification that our meeting was ending in 10 minutes. I'm not quite sure why that is. If we get booted off, Mike, I had to edit myself. I will send you a new link.
Okay.
I'll do it via LinkedIn just to get that just instant message across over to you.
Okay. On LinkedIn, you said?
Yeah. I'll send you a new Zoom link if we get kicked off. I'm not sure. Maybe Zoom have just changed their terms of their conditions.
Okay.
So coming back to leakage, I've spoken to a lot of teachers that have expressed concerns about a child's mental health, about their well-being, their upbringing, their family life, etc. And certainly in the literature that I've read around school shootings in the US, oftentimes the student who did it was not a surprise to the teachers. So what do we need to have in place to allow those teachers to be able to speak up? And what stops them from speaking up from your experience?
Yeah, so I think so often, and we had one I know in California where in Santee, California, where even two adults had overheard him making statements of what his plans were. And, you know, so often people sit there and say, oh, I don't think he really means it. I don't think he's going to do it. Or, you know, in a couple of instances where they actually confront them and they say, oh, I was just joking. I didn't mean it. And, you know, that's the end of it. And there's no further action taken. We saw with the Columbine, one of the students there wrote a pretty significant essay that pretty much he imposed himself into the role of the character of this essay that he had written, and goes on a mass killing of what he described as perps. And so the teacher was significantly alarmed by this and called him in. And in fact, her statement was, it was probably the most violent imagery she had ever read. And again, coming from a senior teacher, that states a lot. And she confronted him about it, and he says, oh, it was just a story. I didn't mean anything by it. But then she brought it up to his parents. And she didn't actually have the essay in front of her, but, you know, the parents kind of said, well, you know, We'll look into it and, you know, have somebody call us if there's any follow-up. And there's no evidence to suggest that, you know, that the parents did have any discussions. Perhaps they did. I know you and I both, if we get a notice from the school teacher that our children had written what they termed, you know, violent imagery that they were concerned about, that we would have gone home and gotten under the hood there to examine, hey, what's going on? Where are you? Why are you writing like this? And, you know, some people can chalk it off and say, hey, you know, even Stephen King, you could probably look at some of his high school writings. And, you know, they were probably very disturbed as well. In fact, the book Rage talks about a school shooting. And, you know, he started that when he was in high school. It was very well written for somebody in high school, but, you know, it's one that several of the school shooters or school killers actually had read themselves. In fact, then Stephen King had the book removed from circulation.
Yeah, I think it's not just limited to teachers as well. I mean, anywhere that people may leak, I guess, as so I've been had this conversation before about faith leaders. At what point does your bond to not say anything become like, well, if I don't say something, this might actually visit me here? I talk to a lot of pastors that have heard some pretty scary stuff. Like I'm thinking about killing my wife. Help me with this. Like at some point we need to escalate that. But then the other side of it is, well, they're a good person. They're going through a hard time. I don't want them to be arrested. And I think sometimes that fear of what the response will be when I raise that question, am I going to ruin their life because they trusted me with something? And I think certainly from a teacher's point of view, talking about a 14-year-old kid that's had a really rough upbringing, I don't want them to, you know, go on some watch list for the rest of their life and, you know, be arrested at gunpoint in my class. Or there's all this sort of fear about what the heavy-handed response will be. And I just wonder whether there's more education required about some of the other response options so that teachers, faith leaders, friends, whoever, parents feel more comfortable bringing it up without fear of the consequence. And I'm sure that's something we've evolved in terms of the sophistication of our response, but that whether that's been messaged out or not is a question.
Yeah, to me, we have a duty to warn. And, you know, there's no way that I want to be sitting, you know, having the knowledge that I knew that this person was in deep despair and was, you know, making statements that were concerning, and I chose not to say anything and just dismissed it. And, you know, I mean, not everybody that you report has to be arrested and jailed. And in fact, I would always say that incarceration is actually the last measure that you use. And trying to find, you know, in the event if they're going through some, you know, financial issues, perhaps, you know, credit counseling, you know, can be called in. You know, you work in workplace violence, you know, the employee assistance program is always a wealth of information, be able to tap into different resources, you know, anger management, mental health, therapy. You know, sometimes they need housing assistance, marriage counseling. I mean, there's all kinds of, and especially in faith-based incidents, they are already plugged into that kind of community where they can tap into all kinds of resources that they have at their disposal. So they don't necessarily have to, I think it has to be documented, and, you know, depending on the level of concern, whether you notify the police or not. And, you know, sadly, sometimes we see that, you know, the police come, especially here in the States, they're underfunded and overworked, and, you know, they've got calls in queue waiting to be responding, and that they don't really have the time to work these cases like, you know, probably should in some instances. And the dispatcher or their sergeant or lieutenant are calling and telling them, hey, we need you to get, you know, 10-8 so you can get another call. Again, a lot of times police officers will, and we saw this with the Buffalo shooting, where they took him in and dropped him off for a mental health evaluation where he had made a threat the previous year to school. And, you know, he was quickly evaluated and then released. And this is the problem that we face. And with a lot of the circumstances, you know, especially with COVID, I think a lot of parents looked at, hey, you know, the kid's on the computer, he's, you know, under the roof here, how much trouble could he be getting into? And, you know, in that case, you know, he became radicalized as a result. And I know that there was one investigation I was involved in where the child was living with his grandparents, and obviously there had been some trauma in his background. But when he, you know, as far as they were concerned, they were church-going folks, and he was upstairs in the bedroom. They didn't think he was getting into any trouble. Well, what they didn't realize was that he was assembling, you know, suppressors or silencers, whatever you want to call them, and firing a handgun into telephone books. And then he had, you know, research at the school, had a map of the school up on the wall, and the windows were blacked out and all that. So, and he was, you know, planning on conducting a school attack. But, you know, grandma and grandpa had no indication that anything was amiss. And, you know, it takes the engagement of parents sometimes to really see, hey, what's going on in their lives. And, you know, I think you had previously talked about there was a book that came out recently, The Violence Project. And, you know, I think in that book, they had expressed a sentiment that, you know, sometimes, you know, an act of, you know, a random act of kindness can change somebody from going on a path of violence, that all of a sudden they find somebody that actually says hello to them and smiles and provides them some reassurance that day, that can make a difference in that person's life that day.
Yeah, that random act of kindness is it's a nice sort of thing to think about. Like, what difference does every interaction make with somebody? One of the things I would like to explore is, as well, we talked about the suicidal ideation, the search for meaning and glory, significance, etc. I did a research project maybe a year ago about the psychological tools used by terrorism recruiters. And what they look for psychologically for someone they're trying to recruit to enact a, you know, or to perform an act of violence. And seldom is it the true believers that are the ones that are actually blowing things up. It's the sad, lonely, isolated kids that are looking for some sort of meaning in their life and some sort of respect and some sort of, you know, overall significance. And I think they're sometimes in hindsight, it's close to a sympathetic figure as you can get when it comes to someone who's murdered a lot of people. But I'd like to just explore some of the other motivations that we've seen. So we've seen some that are based upon racial hatred. We've seen some that were based upon, you know, that were a domestic violence situation that escalated or that ended up just encapsulating everybody around it. So what are the other some of the common motives that you've seen that have led to a mass killing?
So, and you're exactly right when it comes to, again, the radicalization and hate, is that sometimes they're looking for vulnerable people, thugs and losers, as I refer to them in the book, you know, are looking for some, you know, and it's the same philosophy of street gangs. You know, they're looking for somebody that's vulnerable, and at the same time, that person is looking for some acceptance in life. You know, they're not getting it at home, they're not getting it from society, and this becomes their, you know, proxy family, so to speak. And like you said, that rarely are they true believers in that, but this is the cause that they're raising their flag about. And, you know, it provides a certain level of importance to them. But, you know, most of these folks have all are in, you know, serious despair. You know, things are not going well for them in life. If you look at, you know, for an adult, for example, you know, perhaps they've just been, you know, terminated from their job, their spouse has left them. in bankruptcy. The house is in foreclosure. They decide to go down to the liquor store to, you know, drown themselves in misery, but find out the car has been towed out of the driveway. And then they walk back in only to find their goldfish has died as well. So, I mean, it's just one thing on top of another, and they just can't seem to get a break. And I refer to that as the emotional negative vortex, because it, you know, it's been described to me by these individuals I've interviewed, is that, you know, they feel like, you know, that they're circulating, you know, going around the drain, their entire life is being sucked down. And for adolescents, their frame of reference is much different. And you'll see that, you know, for them, they may sit there and say, hey, I failed my geometry test last week. I didn't get the job at the grocery store. And my girlfriend of 2 days just broke up with me. You know, so, you know, for us as adults, we look at that and say, oh, that's nothing, kid, don't worry about it. But for that kid,
don't worry, kid, it's worse.
Yes. And, you know, I mean,
how often is that our reassurance, though? Like, oh, you think it's bad now?
Yeah,
that's gonna help.
And that's why I always say, when you're interviewing these individuals, you really have to, you know, stand in their flip-flops, so to speak, and look at life from their perspective, not yours, but from their perspective, and see, you know, the amount of despair that they're going through. And, you know, quite often they're, you know, they're depressed, that they feel like they've been victimized by society, or, you know, by the employer that they were working for, that the boss was out to get them, they never had a chance. They rarely will take responsibility for their own actions. Wound collectors, you know, they were grievance collectors, whatever you want to call them. You know, I remember the former Los Angeles police officer, Christopher Dorner. So he was able to go back and, you know, recite in his manifesto that in the first grade was his first perceived racial animus that he had incurred. Well, you know, I mean, that may have been a very significant event for him, but from that point forward, he cataloged every single grievance that he ever had in his life, and, you know, was always, you know, pretty much a failure in everything he tried to do. You know, as a result, you know, he blamed everybody else. He never took any responsibility for his own actions. And, you'll see that, you know, a lot of these individuals are, you know, significantly depressed. And I think you've discussed, you know, the warning signs of suicide. But, you know, depression is one of those mental illnesses that's probably the most easily concealed. And, you know, we've seen, you know, comedians, you know, Robin Williams that committed suicide, you know, probably one of the funniest men on earth. And, you know, sometimes you don't know what's really going on behind that facade.
Yeah. You mentioned before that destabilizing factors of someone losing their job or a relationship breakdown and so on. That's something that we all have an obligation just to keep an eye on people in our lives, because you don't know if someone was just holding things together just because this one last thing hadn't happened yet. And now all of a sudden everything that's happened in the last month has been compounded by this last event, especially if it's something really significant, like a job loss, like a relationship breakdown, like a death of a family member. And it's something that we all are in a position. We're all connected on social media now. You all see when someone's had a bad thing happen, and you all see when someone has vented publicly, and then there's reactions of your heart emoji, or alternatively just ignore it because I'm not gonna. Oh, you're venting about your relationship on Facebook, but like these could be warning signs that something's going to happen. And I think a lot of us that are quote unquote psychologically normal, at least self-diagnosed, that you know, there's a phrase for it, and I'm going to butcher it because it's way too early in the morning here, but something like the pull or the lure of the void or something, where you're like, when you're standing on the edge of a building, or you're standing on it in front of a free fall, and part of your brain goes, be like to jump. Like there's that wow, like there's that little tiny voice that goes, just do it, just find out. And hopefully the fact that you're listening to the show means you've probably never done that, but that sort of pull, I mean, what pulls you back from that is all the things you've got to live for, right? The thing that stops you from acting upon that is I've got my kids, my wife, my parents, whatever it is that's going to stop you from ending your life in that moment over some sort of trivial sort of curiosity. If you take those things away, if you don't have that stabilizing force, then I've talked to a lot of friends that were suicidal, and they said the one thing that stopped them from acting upon those suicidal urges was that they didn't want to put their parents through that, or they didn't want to put their kids through that, or whatever. But if that was taken away from you, you lost custody of your children, and all of a sudden you don't, and there's a narrative being built about you that you're a terrible father or a terrible mother or whatever, then all of a sudden that's not a stabilizing force anymore. So those are things I think we all have an obligation to look out for. Not to say that anytime someone has a relationship breakdown, we should report them to the police. But if there's compounding factors, look after those people in your life when they're doing those things, and make sure they do feel that they're supported and they're still part of something bigger than themselves, even though this one thing has gone wrong.
No, you're exactly. I mean, that's 100% correct. And, it was one time I was standing post out in San Francisco and in the shadows of the Golden Gate Bridge. And I was talking to one of the park rangers about, the jumpers. And I said, that's a long way down. And I think we calculated it was about a 4-second drop from the top to the, when you had impact. I said, that's a long way to contemplate your life and think, wow, gee, maybe I made a mistake doing this. And he said that they've had a number of people that have survived. And of those survivors, they all said that they realized once they had jumped that it was too late. It was a mistake. And again, it just, like you said, for those that still have some rational thoughts, can reflect on, hey, listen, I don't want to do this because of, my children or my family. But, I've seen it too, where despite the fact that they know that their children are even going to be the ones that find them, that they still commit suicide. And it shows you the depth of the despair and the darkness that has absolutely consumed them, that they can't even manufacture a rational thought like that.
Yeah, those are the ones that have become harder to comprehend from a sane or psychologically stable point of view, because you're thinking like, how could you do that? But at the same time, if they're in the mindset that this life is worthless, like we think about parents that murder their children before taking their own lives, it's often done from a perspective of, I'm saving my child from this world, and saving yes. the grief of my death by taking them with me. Is like, it's such a broken way of looking at the world, but these are broken people at this point that are
right.
contemplating these things. So there's a lot of that. We are coming up on time. There's so many things we could unpack further. I think I'll probably just to round things out, if you had an encouragement to anyone who's working in a care role, in a protection role, that we've got a lot of people on our listener base that are running security at schools or at universities or at hospitals, that maybe this is something they go to work every day worried about, that maybe today will be the day this happens here. What encouragement or advice would you give to those people?
So I would tell them to, as the gift of fear, listen to that inner voice. If you suspect, and especially when you're around somebody like a coworker, especially, you're with that person for, essentially 8 hours a day. You get to really know somebody, and you can see when they're struggling. And the same if you're a school teacher. Now, it was very difficult during COVID because a lot of it was remote learning, so everything was, being done through Zoom. But, when you have in-person classes, you can actually, start to see that, hey, a particular student's having trouble. And the one thing we saw with the adolescent attackers was that most of them had significant what we refer to as ACEs, which are adverse childhood experiences, childhood trauma, mental, physical, sexual abuse at home, drug abuse, alcohol, criminality, all of that going on in the house. So the support system is not there. And so, like we said, sometimes we have the opportunity to throw a life preserver out to these individuals. and to see what's going on in their life. And if need be, then we need to report that conduct so it can be acted upon. And hopefully who you're reporting it to will take it seriously and actually do their job as well, whether it's human resources or school administrators. And, you know, we've seen sometimes where, you know, threat assessments were not done completely, where, you know, people didn't know how to conduct a threat assessment. And I always urge people, it has to be holistic. You have to interview as many people as you can in that person's life, you know, neighbors, family, friends, fellow students, teachers, coworkers, managers, whoever you can find, and doing the appropriate checks as well to see what's going on and to get a broad view. And obviously, you need to speak to the individual itself to find out, hey, what is going on? And, you know, I've sat in the interview with these people countless times. And sometimes, you know, that they attach themselves to me because I was really the only person that was willing to sit there and provide a listening ear to them. And that they would call me up. I had one individual call me, you know, it was one time I turned on my phone in the morning and there were 26 voicemail messages from him. And he was just providing me as his travel log, but, you know, he looked at me as his new buddy because, again, I was willing to listen to him. But at the same time, each one of those phone calls was kind of a kettle releasing some of the steam and some of the pressure. And I was also able to monitor, you know, what was going on in his life as well.
Yeah, there's so much in that, and look, I really, really appreciate the work you've done, obviously through your law enforcement career, but also in writing the books that you've written, and making your time available for this, folks. If you're out there and you're thinking about you need to prepare for this, get educated. There is so much information. There are so many people like Mike that have a ton of experience that are literally giving it away for free. If you have a Kindle Unlimited account, you can get Mike's book for free.
Yes.
As part of your subscription. And I think it's only about $10 otherwise. So this is something that's keeping you awake at night. $10 to address that might be a good spend. But look, if you're listening to this show, you know, we've had so many people that are committed to being able to help you manage these sorts of issues. There's a ton of information out there. I was just thinking about my two interviews with Jim Kaywood Jim's written the textbooks on threat assessment. You want to know more about threat assessment? Go read those books. Like there's so much we can do.
And he's done 5,000 threat assessment. And I was like, oh my gosh, how is that possible? But, you know, I take him at his word.
Well, he said he stopped counting at 5,000. That might have been 1986. We don't know.
Yeah.
So, Mike, thank you very much for your time. I know you're going to stick around and do some bonus questions for us. But if people want to know more, are you doing speaking? Are you doing any consulting or coaching or anything at the moment?
No, not lately. I did in the previous life, but, you know, the book is out there. You can, I'm on LinkedIn under Mike Roach. And then also I have a website, MikeRoach.com. And then the book is available exclusively through Amazon. So like you said, it's free if you're Kindle Unlimited. Thank you. Yep.
Yeah. No, the Kindle Unlimited has got me many poor books, but this is one of the ones.
Well, and I was very fortunate too that Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, you know, reached out to me and said, hey, has anybody written the foreword on this book? I would like to do that. And so he wrote the foreword, and it's very powerful as well. So I really appreciate it. I was honored to have his endorsement.
Yeah, look, and I mentioned to you before we started recording that it was actually that endorsement that brought you to my attention.
Yeah.
Or, Colonel Grossman share on LinkedIn about the book, and I thought, Dave Grossman's endorsing it. It must be something. And I'm really glad he did, because it is, as I said to you again before we started recording, I've read a number of these books around this topic over the last couple of years. And it is a really well-written book. We didn't talk about the fiction that you've written previously. That's a topic for another time. But Yeah, Mark's a great writer as well as a subject matter expert. So you won't go wrong spending your $10 or your free Kindle Unlimited subscription to pick up that book. And it's not a pamphlet either. There's some serious work that's gone into that. So, all right. Well, that will do us for the interview. Thank you very much, Mark. And if you're a Patreon contributor, make sure you head on over to Patreon and grab the bonus content.
Joe, thank you so much.
Thank you once again to Mike Roach for a fascinating conversation about a very difficult subject. And don't forget, if you are in the US and if you are heading to the GSX conference in Atlanta, Georgia, September 12 to 14, 2022, make sure you come say hello, check out my session. Let's grab a coffee. Would love to meet as many of you as possible at Atlanta, Georgia, September 12 to 14. And I'll be around for a few days afterwards as well. Until next time, stay safe. And I'll talk to you next time.